Okay. It's my honor to introduce to you Dr. Apostol Vasilev. He is a technical director of CMVP and a research team lead in the security testing, validation, and management group at NIST. He leads research in testing methodologies and standards for cryptographic implementations and works with industry, academia, and government agencies to develop and promote better cyber security testing and measurement. Dr. Vasilev holds a PhD in mathematics. He holds 5 U.S. patents and have authored over 30 scientific papers. His work is well respected by the colleagues and the former colleagues. Adding to it, Apostle was my mentor. It has been an invaluable experience for me to learn from him, who has a sharp mind, I would say, and splendid language skills to make hard problems easy to understand. Now please join me in welcoming Apostle to give his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Good morning. When we talk about FIPS 140, I think most of the people in the room would agree that that's a standard, and the program we have around it, the CMVP, has enjoyed a tremendous run over the last couple of decades. And this conference here is a testament of that, essentially bringing together so many people from the industry, government agencies, countries. But today my talk is not about the success of FIPS 140, it's mostly about assessing where we are with the standard and the program, and trying to see, suggest some ideas of where we might take both the standard and the program next. So let me first start with some acknowledgments. Many of the ideas in my presentation this morning are actually the product of countless conversations I've had with my NIST colleagues, Mike Cooper, my boss at NIST, and a few others, Maruja Supaya, Matthew Scholl, and Donna Dodson. So I'm thankful for their thoughtful input and support in this endeavor. So let's look at some of the facts about FIPS 140 from a historical perspective. So FIPS 140 was issued on January 11, 1994, and was developed by a government and industry working group. So if you picture yourself back in 1994, you basically realize that up until the early 90s, cryptography was mostly a government thing, a government technology. And with the advent of, say, internet commerce around the early 90s, mid-90s, society at that point here in this country, our country decided that cryptography has to go mainstream. And yet, even this decision was already kind of accepted, the terms, the exact terms on which cryptography will be used in society were not quite decided just yet. You might remember that back in 94, the debate about the so-called Clipper chip was raging on the pages of the national media. And so after this question was resolved, this debate was settled, cryptography really took off. And if you look at the advances in cryptographic algorithms, cryptographic technologies in academia, government, all these advancements, they speak for themselves. And couple that with the tremendous success or the tremendous development in technology that we have witnessed over the period of these two decades, and you see that things have moved quite amazingly over the course of the last two decades. So in conjunction of that, you know, the second update of FIPS 140 was back in 2001, kind of on the same timeline when the most popular algorithm, symmetric block cipher today, AES, was sort of introduced right at the same time. Again, FIPS 140 was updated, but those were really very modest changes compared to its predecessor. So here we are with struggling with this particular observation, okay? So how do you really keep relevant with the standard that hasn't changed for so long, given these rapid advancements in cryptography and technology in general? So somebody once said that every presentation in cryptography or cybersecurity today needs to have a picture of a big elephant. And I chose to put my elephant, at least here, for the time being, on this question, really. So how do you really keep up with the advancements in cryptography and technology with the standard that hasn't changed for really 20, even more? Because if you remember where 5140 came out from, it came out from an NSA standard that was developed even earlier than that. So we're talking a really, really long period of time. So a little bit about the CMBP itself. I think most of you know what the CMBP is and how it functions, but just to be sure, the mission of the program is really to improve the security and technical quality of cryptographic modules employed by the federal agencies of US and Canada and some industry sectors. Those industry sectors have adopted the standard voluntarily, like banking and other places. But really, the main focus of the CMBP is the federal government, the federal agencies, the civilian part of the federal agencies, not the DOD, NSA parts of the agencies. I'd like to make this very clear. And we do that by developing standards, researching and developing test methods and validation criteria, and most importantly, leveraging accredited independent third-party laboratories to do the testing on behalf of the CMBP. We don't really do any testing at NIST. We rely on our accredited laboratories to do all of that for us. And here, just an idea to give you an understanding of the current state of the CMBP. We leverage quite a few testing laboratories, most of them in North America, but now we have span across continents and have test laboratories in Europe, Taiwan, Japan, and Australia, of course. So we have a really sort of very wide geographic span of the test laboratories that we work with. And so in some idealized sense, this is how the process in CMBP works. You know, the vendor would use the open standard, FIPS 140, as well as all the open algorithm standards. Just to give you a contrast with the previous presentation, we have a really wide open standard and program about that. And vendors would design and manufacture their products according to the specification of the standard. Then they will contract with the cryptographic security testing laboratory to perform the tests. The laboratory would produce a test report, which is then submitted to NIST. Our reviewers will pick it and review it, and if all goes well, then a certificate is being issued. And then the user, which in our case are the federal agencies, have the ability to procure and actually deploy and use this this technology that's get validated. The reality of it, though, is that the four constituents of our program, the government agencies, the industry, the laboratories, and the CMBP itself, really on a different cybersecurity orbit all the time, and it's really hard to keep them aligned, as the previous slide would suggest. And I'm going to get into some of the details of what this really means in the real world we operate. So let's take a look at the CMBP from the industry perspective, at least the perspective that we hear about. Okay, and clearly, some of the the big issues that come through are the long review cycles. You know, it takes a lot of time to for the industry to go through the CNBPQ and have their products validated. In many cases, well beyond product development life cycles. The other big issue that has come through is the fact that the security test requirements do not apply very well when it comes to software in particular, even though software is an acceptable technology to validate. It's not to say that you cannot map the original, say, FIPS 140 requirement to software modules. Yes, you can, and we've done that. But the problem is that sometimes you end up doing things that put a burden on the implementation in terms of complexity or performance, and yet the security benefit from these things is not obvious. And so we have heard loud and clear from many, many technology companies that we have to sort of think about how we capture software in our standard. The other concern that people have raised with us is that even physical testing for hardware modules doesn't go deep enough. And we do some amount and good amount of physical security testing, but we don't cover things yet such as non-invasive stuff or side channels and things like that. At the same time, we have seen this big sort of development in fault injection technologies. People are now able to perform very sophisticated attack on hardware using relatively low-cost systems. So we sort of have to sort of look at that and see how our hardware security testing compares with what the challenges in the real world in this arena are. And another concern that industry has brought to our attention is the fact that we have to do better in terms of coordinating with common criteria. A lot of companies have to go through to both standards in order to satisfy the requirements for procuring systems for national security systems and things of that kind. And people have told us, or companies have told us, that in fact, they're making big investments in going through common criteria and FIPS, and it's highly inefficient if our alignments, if our requirements do not align, really. And so, so far, that has been a fact, and it's a big pain for the industry. And in fact, it's also for the government agencies, because they get delayed, or it's difficult for them to get the products that they want. So let's have a look at the CNBP from another perspective, and that's the perspective of the program and the labs itself. So on one hand, laboratories are concerned with, at least recently, with fast-changing implementation guidance, things that we at the CNBP have tried to do as of recent in order to try to keep up with times. And I told you about this big historic time horizon, and so we have, as of recent, adopted a different stance to the requirements of the standard, going away from the strict constructionism or the literal reading of the test requirements in the standard to a bit more interpretive view of the same requirements, as long as we don't see any underlying security risks by doing that. So the idea is that you can have essentially a good interpretation of the standard that allows you to capture, say, modern day technology without bringing into the picture an underlying security risk. And that's a stance that we're taking, which was different than how the program operated for quite some time, and that created a little bit of noise with the laboratories getting used to the new way of we handle implementation guidance. And just as an idea, the way we think about guidance is the rubber between the industry and our standards. So guidance is really what we have left as a degree of freedom to adjust what some of these old requirements mean for modern day technologies. And on the flip side, though, we have some concerns with the uniform distribution of skill sets among our laboratories. You know, when it comes to specialized technical areas such as entropy testing or physical security testing, we have laboratories who are extremely competent in these areas. It's just that it's not uniform across the board, and that's a problem for the program, you know, because we have to treat every report should be essentially the same, and when it isn't, we have to compensate at the program to come up with compensate for the deficiency, and that adds time, cost, and a lot of effort on everybody's side. But while many of these things related to competencies are resolvable within the constraints of the existing organization of the program, there's deeper issues which are of concern to us, and it has to do with the laboratory's ability to maintain their position of conflict of interest, or essentially to stay stay away from positions of conflict of interest. We have to realize, though, that laboratories are commercial entities. They have their own sort of revenue targets and profit margin targets, and so they operate as business entities, and we're perfectly fine with that, except when this behavior of the laboratories gets in the way of assurance and assurance in security testing. And so let me illustrate that with one example. If you are familiar with biology, biology is the effect or the phenomenon where an animal, after its birth, undergoes significant changes in body structure or organ functions, again, after birth. And so how does this apply to the CMVP? Well, I would illustrate that with some experiences which we see in the program and raise questions for us. And that's what I call the documentation-only metamorphosis of module validations. We get a report, and by the time our reviewers, and they uncover some significant discrepancies during the review, and by the time the review is done, the final module looks very, very different from the module we got described at the time of submission. And obviously, this is not just an isolated case, one or two. We see it every now and then from various laboratories. We see the same phenomenon happening, which obviously raises concerns with the assurances we get from the testing of this module. And we would like to think of it, well, we're thinking about this as a systemic problem that needs to be addressed, and we don't think that it's a matter of just having one or two bad apples in terms of laboratories or testers with them. We'd like to think that this is related to essentially the economic conflict of interest these companies operate in. Okay, so staying with the issues and the perspective on the CMVP, looking at it from an agency perspective, again, the same theme about long review cycles shows up. You know, agencies want to procure the most recent technology that's available to them, and yet it takes a long time for the validation to go through. Another issue that comes with our CMVP is that often our validation results are actually difficult to consume. It turns out that if you want to essentially take a module, deploy it, and start to use it, it's not easy sometimes to navigate the instructions in the security policies or certificates, and we talk about that very frequently with our, say, NIAP counterparts who want to use more and more results from, say, FIPS validations into common criteria, and even then we hear, who are basically experts in navigating our systems, they also have difficulties consuming the results of our program. So clearly, there is some issues to address there, how we represent the features of the modules, the services they have, how can they be configured and used securely is a question that we need, or are questions that we need to address. Another issue that comes up frequently while talking to agencies about FIPS modules is the inability so far to get any real-time FIPS compliance information in the context of a IT system. It's one thing to have, let's say, a validation certificate on the website, but people are interested to know, is my module configured and operating securely in FIPS mode in real time, or in the context of actually being used in federal systems? And there is no really a good way or systematic or standard way to answer these specific questions today. And that's a big issue in terms of being able to consume the results of our validation program in the federal space. And of course, government agencies themselves are concerned about the sort of discrepancy sometimes between our program and NIAP. Sometimes they would ask questions, well, how do I know that a product that uses a module is using it correctly and securely? And we at the FIPS level or the CMVP level don't have necessarily a good answer to that, because our focus is the module itself, not the products that might use it. And at the same time, if the agency happens to be a civilian agency, then it's kind of outside of the purview of NIAP, because the focus there is mostly DoD. So we have a sort of a vacuum area we need to address, which is of concern to our constituency agencies. And so while these were some of the internal challenges that exist in the CMVP, we also have to be aware of what's happening outside of this small ecosystem of CMVP constituency. And some of the big trends that are happening outside of us is the so-called, for one, the Internet of Things, right? Everybody's talking about it. And what does it mean for us? Well, there's many people project an enormous number of devices and technology related to cybersecurity in the next few years, which in my view is going to bring an enormous sort of unprecedented set of cybersecurity challenges related to the development of new cryptographic standards and algorithms associated with lightweight crypto or something like that. There will be a new renewed focus on physical security and crypto leaks via side channels. The interesting thing here is that while there are many technology companies, hardware technology companies that are kind of used to dealing with some of this technology and have a lot of experience in dealing with implementations of cryptography on hardware, the Internet of Things is bringing new actors into this space, new hardware companies who have very little experience. And so I'm concerned that we're going to relearn a lot of hard lessons in cybersecurity and hardware while racing down the paths of the Internet of Things. And so this is just one big theme in the background of where the CMVP operates. There's another significant challenge that exists out there, and that has to do with the economy of cybersecurity, which is slow to emerge. And what do I mean by that? Well, the economy of cybersecurity is different than the economy of technology in general. And last year, The Economist, which is a well-respected British media, did a special report on cybersecurity. And they concluded that there is a market failure in cybersecurity. They concluded that the main reason for that is actually the way computer code is produced. What they observed is that technology companies today, they would produce products, release them, and expect users to use them for a while, discover vulnerabilities, and then patch them. And that model of doing business in technology worked really well for a certain amount of time. But now it turns out that people are able to discover and exploit vulnerabilities before they can be patched. And that's the fun time we live in today, and I don't have to convince you of how many spectacular failures have been reported in the media along these lines. And so when we talk about sort of this sort of economic reasons for failures in cybersecurity, I'm of the opinion that, and not just my opinion, but we have to address these fundamental problems by putting the right incentives in place in order to change the behavior of companies that operate in the business world. What do I mean by that? Well, the easiest example of incentives is actually related to regulations, right? People jump immediately to the conclusion if the industry is not operating in a particular kind of desirable way, well, let's put regulations because that's the strongest form of incentives that you can impose on an industry, right, to change the behavior from one to another. The obvious problem with regulations is that the flip side of it is stifling innovation. And so we at NIST, my ITL, the Information Technology Lab Director, Dr. Chuck Romine, who likes to describe NIST way of thinking about regulation, is that we are aggressively non-regulatory mentality. In the sense that we at NIST don't believe in regulations, we would like to promote best practices and work with the industry to arrive at solutions that they voluntarily adopt and use in their business to promote the value of their products. And so thinking about best practices in this area, I would like to point your attention to some experiences with experience from the automotive industry from, say, 2-3 decades ago. If you recall, back in the 60s or early 70s, the question about car safety was really an open question. And at the time, industry was arguing that implementing car safety features was expensive, and on top of that, consumers didn't really want them. And it was a big debate back in those days until one company actually figured out how to create a competitive advantage out of car safety. And Volvo actually decided that they can take the issue head on and market their cars as the safest cars at that time. And so, long story short, you can see on the right an ad from the 1973, actually on the same Volvo ad on this topic. And long story short, even today, when there's plenty of wonderful, very safe cars, even today when people mention Volvo, safety is an association that comes into your brain. This is how successful that company has been in turning something that was considered business negative into a competitive advantage. And I hope that some of these lessons can be actually reused in our space today. So one more other challenge, external challenge, is of course the evolution of cryptographic technology. We all talk about post-quantum crypto or quantum computing for that matter, and we also have to keep up with the evolution of hacker capabilities. What hackers can do today is a result of one, their own capability enhancement. There are certain advances in factoring that allow quick factorization of, say, low entropy keys. At the same time, The fast development of cryptography has created different sorts of very complex algorithms, some of which are less than robust. In other words, they are secure, but you have to be very careful how you implement it, because if you don't get them right, they're easy to break. And so that creates a whole set of new opportunities for attackers to play with. And finally, of course, I mentioned the availability of low-cost fault injections. And if you combine that with the IoT, you get a combination that can be really painful in the next years to come. So we listed a lot of things, and how do you put it all together, right? If you look for best practice in that arena, well, there is nobody better at putting things together than the Royal Society for putting things on top of other things. For those of you who are familiar with the British classic, the Monty Python, you get the joke. For others, I would encourage you to take a look. You may be amused. Okay, so jokes aside, let's see what we can do to address some of these challenges. So number one thing, well, change the standards. We talked about how FIPS was old, so what can we do? FIPS 140 was old. Let's see what we can do with it. It's well known now, I hope, that FIPS, we're considering actually at NIST adopting ISO 19790 as the next FIPS 140-3. And Mike Cooper spoke about that actually yesterday. And just a few facts here. The comment period closed at the end of September. We are in the process of analyzing feedback. And if I read Mike's comments yesterday correctly, we are sort of coming down on the side that we're going to be recommending that adoption to go forward. Obviously, we haven't finished the internal homework in terms of preparing all the right paperwork and opinions about that, but that's well on the way. And so while we're updating the standards itself, we sort of think that this moment in time provides a rare opportunity to actually take a fresh look at the CMVP and see what we're doing now and how that can be improved. So while we're talking adopting a new standard, I'd like to make one point very clear, and that was actually mentioned in the Federal Register notice itself. Even though NIST is adopting an international standard, we intend to continue to specify the cryptographic modules, modes, and key management schemas that are acceptable for the use of the by the U.S. government. Very, very, very clear and simple message. And so keeping in line with tradition, I mentioned that the previous versions of FIPS 140 were the result of working group between government and industry. We are thinking of organizing, in fact, a working group to engage the industry, academia, labs, and government agencies to come to a table and discuss how best we can go forward, not just in terms of the standard, but how do we organize the testing activities inside the CMVP. And of course, here is my contact information if anyone wants to approach us for that. So one of the issues that I touched upon in my previous slides was the issue about depth and scope of testing. And the way we think about testing currently in the CMVP is that, once the module is designed and manufactured by the developer, a test lab will take it and do 100% of independent tests and all of that. The problem with it is that we're not too sure that this model actually scales well with the sort of the complexity of modules that we see come through, and the fact that in view of the big challenges that are facing us, we want to do better and deeper testing of cryptographic implementations. So the idea here is that instead of asking laboratories to do to retest everything from scratch, the question is, can a vendor adopt certain best practices in-house and produce a lot of test artifacts as a result of their own internal in-house testing that can then be verified by the laboratories to essentially assert that, in fact, a particular implementation conforms to a standard. In other words, reuse developer tests more in the program and focus laboratories on areas that cannot be automated or cannot be tested by the vendors themselves. And that way, transition more of the testing work inside the developer where it naturally belongs, because by doing testing in-house, you're not only improving the security, but also the quality of your product, which is an inherent sort of benefit for the industry. Often quality and security are actually the two sides of the same coin anyway. And so, and that's essentially what we would like to explore. And while we do that, we have to sort of engage the industry and understand what are the best test practices in the various types of technologies, software, hardware, firmware, what are the companies doing today, best practices, and sort of come up with recommendations along these lines and develop as well, not just that, but the measurement criteria. If you are going to be reusing, let's say, test artifacts, how many of them you need to verify at the lab level? You know, what are the criteria for declaring that a spot check is sufficient for asserting that the product is thoroughly tested? So all of these are questions that we don't necessarily have answers for, but these are questions that we're going to bring to the table of the working group that I just mentioned before. So along with this idea of doing more at the vendor and asking them to do better, more testing, and then automate as much as possible, produce test artifacts, we would like to sort of introduce or entertain the idea of a new assurance model that is different than the sort of the binary model of having certificate today or you don't have it. And that's the idea of having essentially a tiered assurance model. That you have a vendor affirmed, and then you have lab tested tier two, and then government validated tier three. The idea is that companies that have those mature development processes in-house can be trusted to participate in the tier one system such that when they finish development of their product and release it, they themselves can assert that they conform to a particular level in with FIPS 140, let's say. And what this would allow, and then later, as their business needs sort of dictate, they can go into, say, tier two or even tier three. But what tier one would allow these companies to do is enter markets that could be happy with just tier one. There are other outside of the federal agency markets that are users of FIPS 140 and allow companies to enter these things early there. And at the same time, shortened the amount of time that a laboratory would need to perform the testing for tier two validation, because you already have the artifacts that are produced by that laboratory, by that company that qualifies them for level one. Then the process of going to level two, hopefully even level three, would become much simpler for this class of companies. I would like to make a quick note here is that I don't want to sound cavalier that it will be very easy for a company to sign up for a tier one, for the tier one self-accreditation schema. Normally, a mature development process in-house is a big thing. It doesn't happen very easy. And it requires a lot of commitment from commercial entities to actually achieve the level of maturity that is needed to implement high-quality cryptographic products. But we're saying that if you are a developer who has these practices in-house, there should be a way for those companies to benefit from their investments and get on a faster track with validations. Those companies that don't have that in-house, well, they have to sort of work with the laboratories to do the testing from A to Z, as it is being done today. And so that's perhaps an incentive for the industry to improve their in-house testing and benefit with validations and certifications of their product later. Not just with that, but we hope that better in-house testing actually improves the quality and competitiveness of their products in general. So related to that is, of course, the kinds of things we do internal to the CMVP in order to improve our own efficiency. And of course, this does not address the bulk of delays or lag in validations, but it's an important part for us to keep our house efficient and optimized and reduce any amount of time that we can to process validations. And currently, we are in the process of rolling out a significant improvement in automation of processing validation data. Mike spoke yesterday about the new automated system of handling validation information within the CMVP, which we rolled out in the beginning of October, I think. And that process is ongoing with projects to automate entirely the algorithm testing as well. And we're looking at a bit of a longer term trend in that of enabling sort of algorithm validations as compared to where it is today. We have a special tool that we work with the laboratories. We're going to try to see if we can promote that to become essentially a web service such that companies can come to, say, NIST, acquire data for algorithm testing, and then submit results and get validation very, very quickly. We have to think about what is the assurance model in that case, how do we know, how much assurance can we get from that, but these are questions that we're trying to address in the near future while sort of keeping up with this idea of automating whatever is possible in our validation programs. And this, by the way, is obviously high on the wish list that we have heard from the industry. There's always a need. Nowadays, every company would approach us and say, hey, how can I get test data for my algorithms to debug my algorithm implementation or the test harness and all of that? And we're hoping that by promoting this sort of approach to algorithm testing, we'd be able to satisfy this need, this industry need. Need well. And of course, we would like to sort of keep up with the industry needs in terms of their ability to access international markets. We work for the Department of Commerce, and it's in our inherent mission to promote U.S. industry and facilitate their access to international market. And of course, and in line with this sort of objective, we are looking to adopt an ISO standard, which is sort of which is an international standard. And the question is, how do we consume this standard inside the program and be aware of the international nature of the standard itself? We are sort of thinking of starting a bit conservatively in this arena by not embracing necessarily the mutual recognition model that is established by common criteria, but start conservatively and establish bilateral partnerships with other validation programs that have adopted the same standard and with whom we have either pre-existing or somewhat close relationship. Canada, Japan, for instance, and countries like that. The idea is that we would like to sort of learn to walk before we can commit to running in this arena, and we would like to sort of understand how we can work with the standard, how can we work with another program. You have to sort of have established trust between two countries before you can freely exchange certification results with them, and trust is not an event, it's a process, it takes time to develop. And so, this is kind of what we think about approach to internationalizing sort of our implementation of FIPS 140-3 based on ISO. Okay. A quick note on how we work with, how do we promote the tiered assurance inside the government agencies. Now, the idea about the three-tier assurance is not just advantageous to the industry by allowing them to enter markets that are sort of outside of the federal government quicker, that can be satisfied with, say, tier one self-assertion. The idea here is to sort of promote this multi-tier, three-tier model inside the federal space. And the way we think it will be beneficial for the industry and for the agency is to adopt a risk management approach to consuming validations from the program. In other words, when a mature tier one eligible company produces their latest product and declares a vendor affirmation for it, federal agencies can start to procure those things much earlier with a risk management mechanism in the background. But the idea is that they can start procuring latest technology much earlier than having to wait until tier two and tier three assurances take place. And of course, as time goes on, most of the risks assumed in the beginning of the process will be retired, and hopefully everything will go well, and the agency will be able to satisfy all the FISMA requirements that go with it. But that's the idea. Essentially, ask agencies to approach the FIPS certification, the consumption of FIPS certification results in a new way. Think of it in terms of risk management and make use of the three-tier assurance model that we hope to convince people is useful. And related to that, and in particular to address some of the problems with conflict of interest with lab testing that I mentioned earlier, one idea here is to introduce a dual reviews for the tier two level of assurance. So not just one laboratory performs the testing for tier two, but two. One verifies the work of the other. Here we're sort of experimenting or entertaining an idea that is used by other government validation programs. In FCC, they use the same model. They have every FCC certification goes and it's certified by two independent labs. And this is not essentially something that we are promoting as a done deal. We are putting this idea for discussion on for the working group to decide what are the pros and cons in adopting this model. The obvious pros for this situation is that we believe we can have a much better handle of the assurance we gain from the tier two certification testing compared to the problems I shared with you earlier in my presentation. The obvious cons are the issues of, you know, IP protection, sharing with more than one. Now, there are companies that work always with more than one laboratory anyway, but we are aware of the issues, but still we'd like to entertain this idea, at least in the context of the working group. And, okay, so a final note here. While we're thinking about changing or how the program operates and the testing works, so we're trying to sort of help the industry and the laboratories by doing research and developing new ideas related to entropy, for example. We're trying to put together an entropy as a service at NIST, a new technology that would hopefully not only provide more or better, stronger key generation. It's not a key generation service, don't get me wrong, but ability to generate keys at the client side, but also be able to attest the key strength at the clients or the system level, and that's something that we're hoping to roll out relatively soon in the beginning of next year. What's the benefit for the program here? Well, if you're getting entropy from a known good quality source, we don't have to ask that many questions during the validation for how strong your keys are. So that's essentially the interest of the CMVP into this sort of research. We're also partnering with academic institutions to promote and develop better cryptographic technology methods that are naturally more leakage resistant, things along the lines of threshold calculations for computations in AES, and for that we are extending grants to research teams in Belgium. In fact, this is the same group that actually invented AES a long time ago. They're conducting some interesting research in the same arena, trying to make AES more resilient with respect to leakage. And of course, we're working actively with the University of Maryland on some of these ideas, including post-quantum crypto. And by that, I mean we're extending grants for doing academic research at these institutions, and we collaborate with them very closely. And of course, we have to think about physical security testing. We're developing rigorous sort of lab competency exams and hoping to get much better at that. And so let me finish with that and open up for questions. Well, I mean, obviously, the SCAP standard is mature, and we know how to do that in an SCAP arena. What hasn't been finalized is what are the hooks we need to provide inside the CMVP to ask modules to provide interfaces to SCAP, sort of so that we can query the status of that. And that's something that we're working on at the moment in the research team to investigate and come up with some recommendations soon.
So you can ask the vendors to also then develop their own content, is that the idea?
Yeah.
Yes, one challenge with new technology that's emerging right now is JavaScript cryptography. There's a lot of interest on that. There are several people working on that. We're working on that ourselves. And the problem there is that JavaScript cryptographic algorithms or modules don't run on any particular hardware. Okay, they are actually interpreted by a browser. There are many browsers out there. Can you give me an idea on how we could go about certifying JavaScript cryptography?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, I think a bit similar to the issues we have with, say, virtualization technologies. They are sort of the same, because if you're looking, if you're thinking about AWS, say Amazon Web Services, in particular, would never specify the hardware platform on which a particular client would work, and that's an issue with the current way we represent sort of operational environment for modules, which is a requirement in the standard. I don't have a specific answer for you, but I know that we're going to be looking at how to address virtualization better in our programs actively in the next few months. We're thinking of organizing another working group or workshop, at least, that includes industry leaders in virtualization, government agencies, academics, and hopefully we'll arrive at some conclusions in the course of the next year or so. And when we do know better, I think some of this analysis would apply to JavaScript as well, for the same reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. We could. I mean, that's a good suggestion. Thank you. On the question of where Tier 1 is being used, I have been in contact with several industry representatives who believe that there are plenty of business sectors for them where Tier 1 would be exactly what is needed. And so there is some anecdotal evidence, at least, that the Tier 1 would be useful even outside of the federal space. Yes. Right. Well, I mean, you know, if we believe that government standards and the assurances we get from them actually are security improvements for the products themselves, they're not just licenses to sell, they actually mean something in terms of security, then an arms race in that would be really welcomed. Because this will benefit not just the government, but everybody in society, and hopefully your business as well. Think about the Volvo effect, right? So I think this would be a welcomed outcome. The key, though, would be to align the government security standards with security of products, and that's the area where, as I mentioned in my presentation in the beginning, we are sort of operating slightly misaligned at the moment, right? Yes. No. What we have is this idea, and I mentioned that we are organizing a working group, and we're hoping to arrive at the requirements for it in conjunction with the industry. We would like to understand what are the best practices in the various technology sectors of the IT industry in general. What works best for software, what works best for hardware, what are the timelines, what are the kinds of tests you do, what are the kinds of artifacts you use, and based on that we will define what are the corresponding best practices. We know now that there are certain standards, for example 27034 is an example of a standard that talks about these kinds of things and what would take for a company to become, say, a mature organization in the context of this standard, but we also know that there is no one hat that fits all. You know, so what works for some companies with 27034 may not work for others, and yet they have other best practices in-house that could be useful in that. We just need to find out what's the best and then come up with some conclusions around that. So as I said, we are looking forward to working with the industry, academia, government agencies, and laboratories to develop and define these criteria for becoming Tier 1 and vendor. Right. Okay. Well, when I talk about mature development processes and things like that, I do mean essentially a better quality product. You know, if you think about it in the context of 27034, it talks about ways to secure the develop secure. I'm sorry to design, to develop and maintain security products. And when you are talking about sophisticated modern day testing, let's say take for example software, it goes well beyond static analysis and code reviews. People are talking about, let's say, dynamic analysis combining with fuzzing and all of that. That's a whole different level of testing that you could subject some product too. Now, I don't want to scare people off and say, well, we're going to expect that, say, the next version of operating system from developer X would have to be all done that way. There are companies that are striving to do that, but it's a very expensive, costly thing to do. But the saving grace for us is the fact that our modules are much smaller in scope than the full product. And so we're hopeful that we can convince the industry somehow to adopt that sort of deeper testing, okay?
If your module is fully compliant, you'll not get cybersecurity because you're not looking at the whole picture.
We're not, but you know, we have to sort of cut our losses somewhere, and we like to think about security in the context of crypto systems. We know that we're not going to solve the entire problem, but we know that if we start on this road, maybe it will lead us somewhere. If people... Of course, but...
When you say there was no product, the market fell. I disagree. If I work at Checkpoint, we produce solutions which protect you against vulnerabilities in other people's products before they can implement their own solution.
Right. I mean, I'm happy to hear that there are companies that that think that they are ahead of the cybersecurity challenges of today, but that's not my conclusion. And in fact, I have to tell you that the Economist actually did a very comprehensive study. The reason I cited it here is not because I fully trust the magazine, but we did our own empirical study. I talked to many, so say, companies. They readily admit that that's actually happening. And so it's a publicly held secret that there is a problem there. okay? And so there's a lot of work to be done to adopt much better development practices before we can hang our hat and declare a win on the cybersecurity, right? Well, yes and no. I mean, just think about it in the context of Heartbleed, right? Okay, so that's a problem that is close to our heart, and it's a problem that resulted from inadequate testing of public open source software. Could this problem have been identified and isolated before with existing technologies for testing that were developed long before the problem occurred? Absolutely. And we demonstrated that. At least we actually had a publication along these lines explaining that you could have taken readily available compiler options and dynamic analysis tools free of charge, open tools that you could use to actually identify the problem. But it is not used. This sort of methodology is not used by the industry at large. And that's the issue. It's not because companies don't know how to do that. It's not because they don't have qualified personnel. It's because the economics of doing business are not aligned well with that. And that's what this article is talking about. You have incentives pointing different way. Because companies today, let's say, are fabulously successful, commercially speaking, even though we are going through a crisis in cybersecurity. So there's two different things. Well, we're not changing the way the final assurances work. We're still going to have government oversight in terms of, verifying test reports, if that's what you're asking for, by NIST reviewers and all of that. That's not going to change. We're just allowing our process to become sort of organized differently so people can recognize assurances much earlier in the cycle and enable, say, government agencies to consume validation products earlier. The overall schema doesn't really change. It's just the way it is instrumented is going to sort of provide a better mechanism for procuring technology earlier in the federal space.
Okay, so tier 3 is like 1 and 2 still have to go to the federal.
Right, right, yeah.